From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet guitarist Mark Knopfler, the founder of the British rock band Dire Straits. Also today, filmmaker Michael Romer tells us why it took more than 20 years for his movie The Plot Against Harry to make it to the screen. The movie was just shown at the Cannes Film Festival. Our film critic Stephen Schiff is in Cannes, where the festival just concluded. Stephen phones in to tell us about the films that won this year's awards. And TV critic David Bianculli gives us a first look at TV's fall lineup. And he answers the question, will Twin Peaks be renewed? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Violence continued in the Israeli-occupied territories today as Arabs protested the massacre of 8 Palestinians by an Israeli civilian yesterday. The men, day laborers in Tel Aviv, were gunned down by a 21-year-old Israeli who was described as deranged. The massacre touched off rioting in which at least 7 more Palestinians were killed by Israeli soldiers. In Amman, Jordan, a 20-year-old Palestinian wounded 10 people aboard a tour bus. Police say the man claimed he was avenging Sunday's killings in the occupied territories. The United Nations Security Council will hold private consultations tomorrow on an Arab request for an urgent meeting on the crisis in the Israeli-occupied territories. A UN spokeswoman said an immediate debate has been requested by 22 Arab nations. A tense police standoff in the town of Melbourne Beach, Florida, is over. The nearly 7-hour drama ended with a gunman dead. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE has this report.
Police identify the gunman as Douglas Pearson, a member of the St. Sebastian Church, where he held off police today. The rampage started at 8:45 a.m. Eastern Time when Pearson critically wounded 43-year-old Diane Canator near his home. He then moved on to St. Sebastian, where he burst in and started firing. Church painter David Arabori was there during the attack.
He was shooting at the phone, at the typewriter, and, he shot, the guy there once.
Arabori then fled for his life. A deacon was reportedly struck in the leg. Police surrounded the building for 7 hours before sending in SWAT teams with tear gas. That's when they found Pearson dead. It's not known what started the attack or if Pearson shot himself to death. Both shooting victims are being treated at a local hospital. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins in Melbourne Beach, Florida.
On Capitol Hill, a bipartisan report released today criticizes El Salvador's top military leaders for overseeing systematic human rights violations. The report comes on the eve of a House vote that would withhold 50% of U.S. military aid to El Salvador. Stella Putnam has more.
The 39-page report says that 14 of the 15 highest-ranking military officers in El Salvador have commanded troops who have repeatedly committed human rights abuses, including torture and rape. In none of the 50 cases listed has any officer been brought to trial or even investigated. According to the report issued by the Arms Control and Foreign Policy Caucus, two-thirds of El Salvador's top military officers have received U.S. training, some for many years. Republican Senator Mark Hatfield, a member of the caucus, says that the report, quote, reveals the complete failure of U.S. attempts to reform and restructure the Salvadoran military. In the last 10 years, the U.S. has sent over $1 billion in military aid to El Salvador. For National Public Radio, I'm Stella Putnam in Washington.
The Dow closed up 25 points today to close at 2,844. This is NPR. The situation is tense in the South African township of Thabong today after police fired on black protesters, killing 7 people and wounding about 40. Police patrolled the area today armed with shotguns and semi-automatic weapons. Witnesses said that protesters were setting up barricades in parts of the township near the gold mining center of Velkom. Velkom's been the scene of repeated clashes between blacks and whites over the past weeks. 2 whites were killed by blacks there last week. Police said today that 3 people had been killed in separate incidents in other parts of the country over the past 24 hours. An unidentified gunman in the city of Medellin assassinated a senator from Colombia's ruling Liberal Party today. And in Bogota, authorities deactivated a bomb apparently set to harm the grandchildren of President Virgilio Barco. Leslie Werpsa has more.
Colombian Senator Federico Estrada Velez and his driver were murdered at midday in Medellin, home of Colombia's most feared drug cartel. A senator was traveling by car in a central area of the city when he was attacked by gunmen in a white Mazda. No one has claimed responsibility for the murder. Mr. Estrada was kidnapped 2 months ago and set free days later by a group thought to be connected to the Medellin drug cartel. The senator had spoken out against the extradition of drug traffickers to the United States. Colombia's interior minister said the murder might be part of the violent plan by drug traffickers to sabotage next Sunday's presidential elections. Meanwhile, radio reports said the police deactivated a 200-pound bomb in Bogota. The bomb was apparently placed near the institute where President Virgilio Barco's grandchildren attend school. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wurpsa in Bogota.
Security forces in the Indian state of Kashmir reportedly fired on a procession of Muslims today, killing at least 41 people and wounding 300. Indian authorities say the shooting happened during a funeral march. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1977, my guest Mark Knopfler took the plunge and quit his secure teaching job to form a rock band. The band's name described the members' financial situation, dire straits. That situation turned around quickly when a demo tape the band sent to a London DJ won them a recording contract, and the song Sultans of Swing became a top 10 hit in the U.S. Dire Straits has continued its success over the years with such hits as Money for Nothing, Walk of Life, and Skate Away. Mark Knopfler is the lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter for the band. He's also composed the scores for several films, including Local Hero, The Princess Bride, and the new film Last Exit to Brooklyn. Knopfler has produced albums by Randy Newman and Steely Dan and wrote Tina Turner's hit Private Dancer. Mark Knopfler's latest project is a band called the Notting Hillbillies. You may have just seen them this past weekend on Saturday Night Live. Their new album, Missing, Presumed Having a Good Time, features songs drawn from and inspired by early rock and roll, gospel, blues, and country and western. I asked Mark Knopfler what aspects of his guitar playing are brought out playing with the Notting Hillbillies.
A lot of the music, a lot of these older things, are, of course, it's acoustic music, so you get all your acoustic guitars a good airing, and you get back to picking a lot. And there's been lots of room to try all kinds of anti-purist ideas, sling in influences from Africa and from everywhere. I mean, we'd do anything, really, as long as it worked. So I'm sure the train spotters won't, the Bluegrass Brigade might not really like the record as such, because it's not a historic, I mean, it's not a reconstruction, really. One or two of the tunes have sort of resisted any innovation, but generally speaking, they've been changed around a lot.
What's a song that you think illustrates the anti-purist approach you've taken to songs?
Oh, I think a very good example would be Railroad Work Song.
Good. Why don't we hear some of that?
Okay.
Railroad Work Song from the new group The Notting Hillbillies with my guest Mark Knopfler, featured on guitar. And Mark Knopfler is the founder, lead singer, and guitarist of the British rock group Dire Straits. You're best known for Dire Straits. You were 28 years old when the group had its first hit, The Sultans of Swing. I think before that you taught English, you'd been a journalist. Had you given up on being a professional musician?
No, the teaching job saved my life. I was trying to be a professional musician, and I ended up teaching for 3 years because it enabled me to get my own transport and to be able to play nights with rock and roll bands and stuff. So it was actually one of the best things, I think, that happened teaching. And it also enabled me to, because of the summer breaks in 76, I managed to get myself all the way around America.
Did the students know that their teacher was a rock guitarist?
Yes, I'm afraid so, because we used to play there at the college quite a bit too, and they'd get to see Mark jumping up and down in the air in a white suit.
Did you come up with the name of Dire Straits?
No, it was another starving musician who was living in the drummer's house. He was a pianist, only met him once, and he'd come up with that.
Did you like the name right away?
Yes, it made all kinds of sense. Apart from anything else, the state, I seem to remember, the general consensus in England at the time was that the country was in that situation anyway. So, and it was pretty much applicable to us, because we'd given up our jobs, and we were those of us who had jobs, the three of us who had jobs, and we were living on quite a lot of lentil soup.
Mm-hmm. The band's first hit, at least in America, was Sultans of Swing, which I think was 1978 when it came out.
That's right.
The story, the lyrics are about a trad jazz band that they all have day jobs and they play on the weekends, and they're good musicians and this is their big release. Were you afraid that you were going to become that the rock equivalent of that, where you'd have a day job and on the weekends you could let loose and play?
I was worried. I remember sometimes going to work and thinking, crikey, this isn't going to be me. And yes, and I just knew that it wasn't going to be the picture. And I mean, I didn't have the... Although I enjoyed teaching, I enjoyed my students, and I got them through all their exams and everything, I took my marking quite seriously, I remember. But I didn't have that professional commitment to it that's required. It was the same really for journalism. I can't see really say it was journalism. It was more of cub reporting, which I did for a couple of years before I went to university, that you've got to be compulsive about it. And it was a job that I could do. I had a lot of energy and drive when I was 18, 19. And I couldn't get that excited about getting a scoop or something.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have it sort of printer's ink in your veins. You've got to have that compulsion. And really, the compulsion with me has always been to stay up late playing and falling asleep with the guitar. In fact, that's how John met me. I know one of the guys in the band met me, I remember, down in Deptford. Was just him coming. He'd been out all night. He came in the morning, and there I was in his flat, lying on the floor, with a guitar across. That was basically what used to happen. You'd fall asleep just playing licks until essentially you're playing in your sleep.
Was there an actual band that you saw that you wrote Sultans of Swing about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what they called themselves.
Oh, that was really their name?
Yeah, that's right. They were, when you say good musicians, they were the classic little trad band playing New Orleans. Is a pretty... You'd get them in a lot of pubs and places around England. There's postmen and maths teachers and whatever it is that they do, and they just get together and play Louis Armstrong solos if they can.
Well, why don't we listen to Sultans of Swing, this record from 1978. Dire Straits, my guest Mark Knopfler, wrote the song. He plays lead guitar, sings vocals, and here it is.
Shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside, many things.
station in all the places. But the horns, they blowing that sound way on down south.
My guest is Mark Knopfler. He's the founder, lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter of the British rock band Dire Straits. Now, you were telling me that this record, Sultans of Swing, was actually not even played on British radio while it was a hit in the U.S.
That's right. It was a hit all over the world, in fact. But then Radio 1 in England, which, of course, you know, you have 2 million radio stations in America at that point. At that time, I think we had one in England, the BBC. And pop records... were subject to the scrutiny of a committee headed by a lady called Doreen or something, this peroxide thing, who she sort of chaired this committee, and they turned Sultans of Swing down as a candidate for the British public because, and I quote, it had too many words.
Really? What was that supposed to mean exactly?
I never even bothered to find out. And then it became a hit there about a year later.
How did it become a hit if it wasn't played on BBC?
I think once it had become a hit in America, they were sort of it. And then there was a show that played American, the American top whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when it was number one in America, then they sort of had to start playing it. I think they must have had a call or two or something. I really don't know. But then anyway, eventually... we became mightily popular in the UK and remain so to this day, despite Doreen. Or Doris. I think it's Doreen. It was.
What were some of the stories about who you really were that circulated in the States that really seemed absurd to you after Sultans of Swing was released? Or impressions of who you were and who you'd patterned yourself on?
I don't remember any of that at all. People used to talk about influences, of course, which are absolutely true, that people would, simply because I'm not a singer, it has a sort of a Dylan-esque influence and sound to it, and I think that's absolutely right. Bob Dylan has been an influence on me since I was 11 years old, I first heard that.
Did he influence you in part because you didn't think of yourself as a singer? Did he almost, like, give you permission to sing?
It could be partly that. I didn't think of myself as a singer, you're right. And, in fact, I still don't.
Well, you kind of developed this half-speaking, half-singing style of doing vocals.
Well, it's probably just really from not being able to sing, and that's the top and the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the guitar would end up probably taking over where the voice just couldn't go. And it's not so much a question of running out of words. I just probably couldn't sing too well and can't. So that's just the way that it is.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Mark Knopfler. He's the founder, lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter of the British rock band Dire Straits. He has a new record, and this is with a group called the Notting Hillbillies, and they play music influenced by early rock and roll, gospel, blues, and country and western. Their new album is called Missing, Presumed Having a Good Time. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mark Knopfler is my guest. We were talking about your singing. Let's talk a little bit about your guitar playing. I think it's very easy to identify your guitar sound on a record. Was there a point where you realized you had your own sound, your own voice, after probably trying to imitate a lot of your influences and heroes?
Yes. I proceeded along a couple of lines, parallel lines of acoustic playing and electric playing. because I couldn't afford an amplifier in the early stages, but I was stuck with this electric guitar that I had to have. I borrowed friends' acoustic guitars and ended up playing in folk joints and eventually in small blues places as well, clubs and so on and so forth. Eventually picking styles and flat pick styles and finger picking styles synthesized, and I ended up using a flat pick less and less. And this synthesis of different kinds of music and different styles of playing, and that's really when it all came about after playing for probably, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. Eventually this style, what people would say is a style developed, and it's style is something that you can't define, you can only recognize it, but that's what happened.
You grew up in Glasgow and then in, what, Northern England?
Yeah, well, I was born in Glasgow, but when I was about 6 or 7, I moved to Newcastle-on-Tyne, which is a northeast, people from Newcastle are called Geordies, and that's really what I consider myself to be, from the northeast.
Your father was a refugee. He had fled Hungary, I think in the 1940s?
Yeah, end of the 30s, yeah.
Why did he flee, and what effect did that have on you when you were growing up to a father who was from another country? And I don't know if he spoke English very well when you were growing up.
Well, no, he had English pretty well off. He always spoke with an accent. But he was just part of the general refugee movement in Europe, across Europe at that time, and he married a Geordie girl. And so I just grew up basically the same as all the other kids, and local schools and everything else, but I'm very glad that, in a way, that I had one parent who was an outsider to a certain extent, because I think it sharpens your perception of, you get the advantage of a different point of view on English life, British life, if you like, all the time. That, I think, has been important.
Let me ask you about another song that you wrote for Dire Straits, and this is Money for Nothing. This is a persona song. It's written in the persona of someone who works for an appliance store, installing kitchens and moving TVs and refrigerators. And he thinks that rock musicians really have it easy. They get their money for nothing and their chicks for free just by playing guitar and maybe getting a blister on their finger. Were you frustrated by people who envied rock musicians because the life was so easy? I mean, does that bother you?
No, it was just one of those situations. The guy was an ignoramus, obviously.
Well, what guy? Who was he that you modeled this on?
He was really enough. He was in the store. It was a New York store.
An appliance store?
Yeah, and I was just there. We were there looking for some kind of appliance, something for the kitchen. And it was actually all going on. There was a wall of TV sets at the back, and these rows of refrigerators and gas stoves and God knows what. And there was a kitchen display unit in the front of the store in the window, of a model kitchen. In fact, after I saw all this going down, I actually borrowed a piece of paper and a pen from somebody in the store, and I sat in the kitchen display area in the window of the store and started writing down some of these things that this guy was saying, you know, because they were such classic lines.
Such as, what are some of the things he actually said that you used in the song?
That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Maybe you get a blister on your finger or something. And a lot of the language, of course, I couldn't really... it was a lot worse than I mean, in sound checks I might sing sometimes I might just use some of the real language, but I think most people got the picture, and it's a kind of most people I would think were amused by it more than anything else. And there's a grain of truth, of course, in what he's saying, because there is that perception. Sometimes it's accurate. And some people in music, of course, don't work very hard, and they just are there, and everything's really more or less done for them. But generally speaking, I think it's just as hard as anything else. And people work, a lot of musicians work very hard,
One more thing about Money for Nothing. This fellow in the appliance store, did he recognize you? Is that what led to...
Oh, no, no. I was actually spying on him. I had to find... I didn't want to get too close because it was such a classic situation. He had his little audience of two and he was just away. And I had to sort of back off a little bit because he couldn't be seen to be saying what he was saying, maybe in front of the customer. So I actually found a little sort of spy hole in between a couple of microwaves and down one of the alleys and just sort of watched him for a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear Money for Nothing, and this is Dire Straits.
Look at them yo-yos, that's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working, that's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Now that ain't working, that's the way you do it. Let me tell you, them guys ain't dumb. Maybe get a blister on your little finger. Maybe get a blister on your thumb. We got to install microwave ovens, custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs.
That's Dire Straits, and my guest is the founder, leader, lead guitarist, and lead singer of Dire Straits, Mark Knopfler. You're pretty famous both in the United States and in England. Do you think that British and American fans kind of want different things or expect different things?
No,
from their rock stars.
Well, if you were to watch MTV all the time or something, I think you'd be very easy to get depressed about expectations and output and giving people what they want and so on and so forth and. I think probably the conservatism in American rock and roll is one of the most obvious things. When you see these clone groups playing and posing around in their PVC suits and so on and so forth.
Did anyone ever try to make you into a clone of somebody else?
No.
Have you ever had to resist that?
No, I think being successful from the beginning has meant that the record companies, God bless them, have never really lent on me to go in any particular direction. And I mean, I haven't made it easy for management and people like that by being sidetracked so much with dreaming other people's dreams and getting involved in production things and doing all this film stuff. To be fair, I think that I should be doing a little bit less of that and concentrating more on keeping Dire Straits intact and, you know, getting another record out and going around the world, which I'm actually looking forward to doing, in fact.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Mark Knopfler's band, the Notting Hillbillies, has a new album called Missing, Presumed Having a Good Time. Knopfler also scored the music for the new film Last Exit to Brooklyn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Michael Hare. His memoir, Dispatches, was one of the most highly acclaimed books on the Vietnam War. His new book is a novel about Walter Winchell. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It wasn't easy getting the comedy The Plot Against Harry into movie theaters. It's the story of a small-time gangster who goes legit by buying into his ex-brother-in-law's catering business. It's also the story of Harry's alienation from his middle-class Jewish family. No one laughed 20 years ago when the movie was made. No one released the movie either until last year. Now the film's getting both laughs and good reviews. Coming up, we meet the man who made the movie, Michael Romer. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff phones in from France, where the Cannes Film Festival has just ended. And TV critic David Bianculli has the news on ABC's fall lineup and their plans for Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the Middle East, in a second day of widespread rioting in the Gaza Strip, three Palestinians were killed in spite of an army curfew. Linda Gradstein reports.
Today was the first of 3 days of mourning and protest against yesterday's killing of eight Gaza Palestinians by an emotionally disturbed Israeli gunman. Much of the West Bank and the entire Gaza Strip was under curfew, but Palestinians ignored the curfew and clashed with soldiers all over the Strip. Three Palestinians were killed, a 16-year-old girl from Gaza City, a 55-year-old woman from Khan Yunis, and a 22-year-old man from Rafah refugee camp. The army said that the circumstances of their deaths were not clear and are being investigated. The army said 14 residents were wounded, but Palestinians said the number was closer to 100. At least 17 Palestinians have been killed over the last 2 days. The Israeli army was on special alert today, and three soldiers were injured by stones. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In Washington, for the second time in 2 weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled against an anti-abortion group. The High Court has refused to allow entrances to abortion clinics in New York to be blocked. The court left standing an order in which a federal court judge permanently banned members of the Operation Rescue Group from interfering with women entering New York area abortion clinics. There are similar injunctions in other cities. And it appears that U.S. taxpayers will be footing the bill for former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega's legal fees. As Jeff White reports, attorneys for the U.S. government and Noriega have reached tentative agreement on the plan.
Noriega's attorneys had asked a federal judge to allow them to withdraw from the case since Noriega can't pay them. That's because the U.S. government has frozen all of the ex-Panamanian leader's assets since it says they were obtained from drug trafficking. The government is still unwilling to release even a portion of Noriega's assets so he can pay his legal fees. But under the Federal Criminal Justice Act, the U.S. government could pay Noriega's lawyers at a rate to be determined by a federal judge. If at a later time Noriega is returned, all or part of his frozen assets, he would reimburse the government for his legal expenses. District Judge William Hoover will hear arguments this Thursday on just how much money Noriega's attorneys should receive. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
South African President F.W. de Klerk, now on a visit to Europe, has called on German businessmen to invest in his country. Speaking today at a news conference in Bonn, de Klerk said that he did not go to Europe with the intention of lobbying against sanctions imposed on South Africa to protest its apartheid policies. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 25 points to close at another record high of 2,844.68. There was active trading of some 167 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The Cannes Film Festival just wrapped up. It's by far the largest and most important of the international film festivals. As soon as the award ceremonies were over, our film critic Stephen Schiff got out of his tuxedo and gave us a call. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Well, tell us about the film that won the best film, the Golden Palm Award, and it's David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart.
That's right. This shows an unusually intelligent jury because it was the best film in a pretty lackluster competition. But it's also a really, in the version we saw anyway, it's a tough, wild, rough film. You know, with lots of gore and violence. It so far has an X rating. Whether they cut it to an R remains to be seen. And it's an extraordinary film. And I think the jury's to be congratulated. It was headed by Bernardo Bertolucci, who's an unusually smart and cinematic kind of jury head, and it was very exciting. David Lynch got up there to receive it. There was a standing ovation. At the same time, there were choruses of boos, which I think had a French accent, if my ears did not deceive me. And then the cheering would die down, David Lynch getting redder in the face by the second. Then the boos starting up again, the cheers. It was a real French evening.
What were the boos for? Why was this film so unpopular among some of the people at the ceremony?
Partly because a lot of people here think it's sort of almost an exploitation film. It's very violent. I mean, heads get chopped off and fly through the air, and there's a lot of sex and a lot of blood and a lot of kind of a lot of filthy talk. To my mind, it's the kind of film that directors make after their breakthrough film. You know, after Carrie, Brian De Palma makes The Fury, after Psycho, Hitchcock makes The Birds, and after Blue Velvet, David Lynch makes Wild at Heart. It's got style to burn. At the same time, it's not as kind of shapely and well organized, and it doesn't have as kind of singular an effect as Blue Velvet. But it's a pretty interesting movie with a lot of excitement in it.
What about the Best Actor and Best Actress awards?
Well, I thought the Best Actor choice was pretty good. Gerard Depardieu won for playing Cyrano de Bergerac in a film by Jean-Paul Rapneau, and this film will be distributed in America, and it's a really pretty good version of Cyrano. It's been well adapted, well cut. It moves right along, and the performance is really smashing. The Best Actress award went to Christina Yanda, and there was almost no competition. There were very few sterling performances by actresses. She was in a movie called The Interrogation, a Polish movie that's been suppressed for about 8 years and is in the new Eastern European environment, was finally released. And that movie has become such a legend in Poland that by the time of its first showing in Gdansk at the end of last year, virtually everyone in Poland had already seen it in kind of underground videotapes. But still, they flocked to the first showing and gave her a standing ovation. And she gives a great performance in it. It's not a very good film.
Were there other films that registered the changes in Eastern Europe?
There were a lot of kind of suppressed films surfacing, and you know, they were long awaited, and they may as well have been less suppressed by my aesthetic. They were mostly not very good. But the new mood overseas was registered here. There's an interesting film that won the Best Director Award for its director Pavel Longuin, and the film is called Taxi Blues, and that will also come to the States. And it's a very jazzy kind of urban look at Moscow, a town we don't think of as jazzy and urban. You know, it has sort of that city sizzle that we might expect from an American film about urban situations. But you know, there's no tractors in this movie.
Two of the big movies that showed at Cannes were, one was directed by Clint Eastwood and one by Akira Kurosawa. What'd you think of the films?
I thought they were both pretty disappointing, and a lot of people here did. Kurosawa, his film is Dreams, and it's just very, very dull. The Eastwood film, White Hunter Black Heart, has Eastwood playing John Huston in the pre-production for The African Queen, and he does a John Huston imitation, which is, I find, very embarrassing. It really shows his limitations as an actor.
So big disappointments, huh?
Afraid so.
How did this Cannes Film Festival compare to other ones you've gone to?
Almost everyone here agrees that it was a pretty lackluster festival, almost scarily so, because for one thing, all the films in competition were quite disappointing. For another thing, the market here, which has always given Cannes this kind of crazy, vulgar, underground life, is dying too. There are no B movies here this year because Cannes has become prohibitively expensive for people with small budgets to bring their films to buy and sell here. There are now other markets like the American film market, which has been going on for 5 years and so has really established itself, at which these people can sell their wares and buy films more cheaply and more effectively. Here, if they want to buy a glass of champagne for themselves and for their client on the Carlton Terrace, it'll cost them $50. Really lousy little hotel rooms begin at $300. And that means that if these people can't come, and a certain life goes out of the festival. The kind of vulgar life of people marketing films like, you know, in recent years, Surf Nazis Must Die, that kind of thing, and people dressing as Martians and weirdos on the beach and parading around, that kind of thing is going away, and it's sad. I mean, because part of what one loves about Cannes is this mix of high art and extreme vulgarity.
So, Stephen, of the whole Cannes Film Festival, do you have a favorite moment?
Favorite moments? There was a moment when Sylvester Stallone came through the crowds along the Croisette, and his car was so mobbed that he had to stop. And so he got out and stood on top of the car and raised his Rocky salute while all of France cheered. A moment of horror or a moment of pleasure, I just don't know.
Stephen, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Sure, great pleasure.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic. He's also a critic at large for Vanity Fair, and he spoke to us from a phone at the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. One of the films that just showed at the Cannes Film Festival, The Plot Against Harry, took 20 years to get into theaters. It's a comedy, but no one laughed at the time it was made, so it was never released. A few months ago, we interviewed the writer and director, Michael Romer. That was a few weeks after the film had opened in New York. Since then, the film has been gradually opening in cities around the country. The Plot Against Harry centers around Harry Plotnick, a small-time numbers racketeer, alienated from the values of his estranged middle-class Jewish family. The film opens as Harry gets out of jail. Before making The Plot Against Harry, Romer and Robert Young made the film Nothing But a Man, about a black couple in the South. I had read that Romer made The Plot Against Harry to get closer to his own experiences, but I wondered what a Harvard-educated filmmaker had in common with an ex-con.
Well, you know, there's an old affinity between so-called artists, filmmakers, writers, poets, painters, who I think often feel themselves to be outsiders, and that part of the society that operates on the lam or on the outside, namely, you know, if not hoods and gangsters, well, confidence artists and people like that. So I think that I felt close to someone who was on the outside and trying to make it in and, you know.
Well, your movie is from the point of view of a small-time criminal's view of the Jewish middle class. Now, you were a different kind of outsider in a way because you emigrated to the United States with no family, I believe, after the Holocaust. You grew up, I believe, in Germany and went to England during the war and then came to the States when you were a teenager. Can you tell me how you were sent to England on the children's transport? Who was chosen and how?
I don't know how the administration of those things worked. I know that late in 38 and then until September 39, when hostilities actually broke out and all had to stop, parents in Germany became very, very alarmed, for very good reason, of course, and they started to look for any way to get their children out, even if they themselves couldn't get out. And there were these trains, I think there were 10,000 children all in all who went out that way, who went from Berlin to England. The parents just, you know, said goodbye at the railroad stations in Berlin and went on to, some of them went on to the next station. There are a lot of stations in these big European cities. And just to see the train go through one more time and to wave to the train, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't even look out the window, I don't think. But I know my mother said she was standing at the next station, waving to the train as it went by. It's a heartbreaking image if one thinks that a great many parents never, of course, saw their children again because they died. You know, their children never saw their parents again.
Did you have any idea why you were being sent away?
Vague, very vague. I knew about anti-Semitism. I mean, I was, in a very small, personal way, victimized by German kids on our street who had been my friends who suddenly turned on me because I was Jewish. But and I knew that my family was very upset, and my mother, my grandparents, and that the business they were in was being dismantled and destroyed. And but, you know, it's hard. All I remember is that I was told to pack, and the next thing I remember is hoarding chocolate and putting it, endless bars of chocolate, into my suitcase and going to the train station. That's how I remember it. And then I remember a tremendous sense of relief as soon as we crossed the German border. So I must have understood something.
So you spent the war years in England.
Yeah, I was in a school mostly for refugee children in England, a wonderful school, a really marvelous boarding school that is still, in many ways, my family, children who went to that school with me, and even the adults, I'm still in touch with some of them, and it is like a family, you know. For 6 years, I lived very intensively with 120 other children who, or a great many of them without parents. And
how did you come to the States?
Well, my mother actually got out in 1941, and she went to Portugal, and then from Portugal to the United States. And so when the war was drawing to its end, they permitted a certain number of the children to rejoin family in the United States. And that's how my sister and I actually got out.
In your movie, The Plot Against Harry, Harry, who's the guy who runs the numbers racket, he decides to go legit and goes into a catering business with his ex-brother-in-law, Leo. And so this is a catering business that specializes in bar mitzvahs and weddings.
Right.
And it strikes me that you probably didn't have an extended family in the States who were always inviting you to bar mitzvahs and weddings and stuff.
No, this was, of course, partly, again, I think you're quite astute. I've never thought of that part of it, but I think you've put your finger on something that is probably psychologically there, that I didn't have any of those things and that I was the Harry who was trying to join it. If that's what you're getting at, that's absolutely true. And of course, the whole East European community, East European Jewish community, was what I would look at with longing, with all its festivities and its sense of family. I was in a very small family, you know. There's no extended family that I remember at all, and very little sense of community. And so perhaps I think you're right. to point out that I sort of adopted that as something I wanted to be part of, and that part of the story comes out of that, you know.
Now, the way I understand what happened is when you first showed the Plot Against Harry to friends, to potential backers, to film executives, nobody laughed, right?
That's right.
Now everybody realizes that, you know, the film's gotten a wonderful reception. People think it's really pretty funny. What is it about the movie, or about your sense of humor as conveyed through the movie, that people didn't get then and that they do get now?
I wish I knew. I mean, everyone has been wondering about that, and I've said that I thought part of the problem was that originally the film moved too fast, which is true. At the time, 20 years ago, people couldn't pick up the information quickly enough. That was part of it. I think another part of it has to do with distance. If it's your own time and your own place and your own activity, it's harder to see the thing as funny. When you look from a distance, and that could be a distance in time, 20 years, then the things that seemed just photographic reality acquire a slightly different tonality, perhaps. It's a possibility. I honestly don't know. A third possibility could be that we are much more comfortable with ethnicity than we used to be, and that people were a little bit nervous or a little bit sensitive to the fact that this is a Jewish community that isn't already in the suburbs and lawyers and, you know, doctors and professors, but these are just ordinary, plain, middle class and even lower middle class people, and they're just like every other ethnic community that's working its way into the middle class.
Can I offer another possibility, too?
Please do. I'll use it the next interview.
That I think the generation that was growing up while you were making the movie was a generation that grew up maybe slightly more alienated from their
absolutely.
Extended family.
I think that's absolutely part of it. And I think the film does speak to them, these younger people today, in just that way. I think there were people, perhaps already like me, as I was then, you know, who are now looking back at that period and enjoying the fact that there's an outsider being at a bar mitzvah when perhaps they were just a little bit outside their own bar mitzvahs. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that's true, but it could be. I think that there is such a generation, perhaps.
You taught for many years. Are you still teaching?
Yeah. I still teach. I started before we started making Harry. I was asked to teach at Yale, and since I'd made so many movies, just trying to make a living, this seemed like a very good alternative to making films I didn't want to make, just to keep, you know, our three children halfway closed and fed. And so I've been teaching for the last, since 1966, and I still teach.
Now that the plot against Harry has not only been released, but is really a wonderful success, what kind of offers are you getting now?
Well, it's interesting. People have projects, and they'd like to hire you to direct their films, or possibly to adapt a book that they've bought the rights to. And my own experience is that I'm not really as good as many other people in doing that kind of thing, and that I need to stick with my own material and do that.
Do you have screenplays that are already written in your drawer, ready to go?
Yep. I always think if opportunity knocks, I'll have the door open before they finish knocking. I keep writing stories, and I don't go out and hustle money anymore. I've done that, but at this time, I'm unwilling to spend a year or a year and a half as I did for my last film, just raising money. So I'm hoping that perhaps a miracle will happen again, as indeed it did with the plot against Harry. I mean, somebody literally came, a man from Seattle, King Broadcasting, and said, "We liked your last film. What would you like to do?" And so we made Harry.
Michael Romer, he wrote and directed The Plot Against Harry. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the Romanian election?
Well, Terry, today we'll be talking with one of the students who have been protesting in the middle of Bucharest, the Romanian capital, demanding an end to communist rule in that country. You know, the National Salvation Front, which is composed mainly of former Communist Party members, seems to have taken an enormous lead in the in Sunday's elections. Also, news today of more violence in the occupied territories of Israel following the killing by an Israeli over the weekend of 7 Palestinians, and to talk with actress Blair Brown, whose new movie is called Strapless.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The networks are starting to release their plans for the fall schedule. ABC is the first to announce the fall lineup, and TV critic David Bianculli just found out what it is. David, I think the question everybody wants to know is, will Twin Peaks be back in the fall?
Yes, it will. That's the great news. The bad news is they've moved it. They're putting it on Saturday night at 10 o'clock, which is one of the dumb things I can think that ABC could do, because that's a night when all the people who are the kind of people who would watch Twin Peaks would be out. Thursday was the perfect night for them. It was doing great. They'll probably move it back once it starts to bomb on Saturday, if it does. But that's not a good night for it. But it is back.
What else is in the ABC lineup?
The nice things to look forward to, even though I won't see these for another 3 or 4 weeks. Steve Bochco, who is Doogie Howser in L.A. Law and all that, has a new series called Cop Rock, which is kind of like a drama musical. The bad things sound like there's a Look Who's Talking spinoff called Baby Talk.
Oh.
I know, those sorts of things. And America's Funniest Videos Part 2, which is distinguished from Part 1 in that it has people intentionally rather than accidentally being funny, theoretically funny, funny being a large, wide term here. So that's a couple of the others. Gabriel's Fire has James Earl Jones back in a drama series. And there's two others that are kind of negligible at this point. But it's still better than ABC has done in a long time in terms of going for different sorts of things.
Do you think ABC has changed its image since the Love Boat days?
Oh, completely. I mean, they've now lapped NBC, I think, as the quality network, because NBC used to have it for most of the 80s, but they're just sort of coasting on their glory. And ABC, between ABC and Fox, that's where most of the innovation is these days.
What's responsible for the change?
I think a lot of it is that desperation, usually when a network is third place, or when you're Fox, you're fourth place. You do try new things. The Simpsons is a wonderful thing that, you know, CBS, when it was number one, NBC just would never try.
Let's get back to Twin Peaks for a second. What does it mean, do you think, that it's going to be back in the fall? Everybody was wondering, will the series be renewed or not? What implications do you think this has for future programming?
It did better than I thought it was going to do, and I am so thrilled that it did, because even though the viewing audience has dropped off, there's enough that has stayed there that it means that all of Hollywood is going to start trying to do different things because the audience is there. Now, Twin Peaks is not getting a giant audience, but the network share of audience, the pie, has shrunk. So the Twin Peaks piece of the pie, which would have gotten it canceled 5 years ago, is now enough. It's viable. So we're going to see lots of good shows going for small audiences. And if it can hold those and retain them, it's a success instead of a failure. That's big good news for TV as we come into next season, and specifically, you know, 90, 91.
David, does the renewal of Twin Peaks mean that we do or don't find out who killed Laura Palmer?
I think that we will eventually find it out, but I'll tell you, people are starting to really press me on this issue, and I don't
it's
not.
It's one of the big
I
issues.
I not only don't know who killed Laura Palmer, I have two or three theories, and I don't like any of them, but I don't think it matters anymore. I get as excited, you know, watching Cooper eat a slice of pie or drink a cup of coffee as I do, you know, getting a new clue about Laura Palmer. At this point, it's the style.
Okay, well, David Bianculli, thanks for giving us the new schedule for ABC.
I'm glad to do it.
And David Bianculli is the television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. The show is produced today by Fred Landerl. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Hare wrote one of the most highly regarded books about the Vietnam War, Dispatches. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Hare about Vietnam and about his new novel. Also, screenwriter and director James Toback talks with us about gambling, rock and roll oldies, sex, and other obsessions that inspire his movies. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.